You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, December 16th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. On this day in 1935, the use of eye prints, which are patterns of the capillaries in the retina, was described in an article in Time magazine as a new scientific method for identification because an individual's eye pattern is as unique as fingerprints.
Yeah, well, that explains why we're all using eye prints to get into our houses and
well, the problem is it got a little messy when they had to, you know, roll the ink on the eye and kind of press it on the paper. So I think they abandoned it.
Ew.
I'm sure high-tech installations are using that. It's for biometric analysis. It's great. It's really good. But there's better things now. An iris imager, you know, your irises are more unique than even your DNA.
Mm-hmm.
That blew me away when I read that.
Wow.
How can something be more unique than your DNA? But it is. It's amazingly unique for each person, even twins. And
you know, but it almost sounds like a pseudoscience on the surface, I guess, until you start realizing that it's actually legitimate.
Well, there is iridology.
Yeah, that's not to be mistaken with that, though.
Right. Iridology.
And by the way, Evan, I'll be pedantic before our listeners get to. You're not looking at the capillaries in the eye. Capillaries are microscopic. You're actually looking at arteries and veins.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was reading directly from the website from where I got it. So
yeah, well, what you can see with an ophthalmoscope when you look at the retina are arteries and veins. You can't see the capillaries unless you have more extreme magnification.
Steve, arteries? Steve, you're not looking at arteries.
They're arteries and veins.
In the back of your eye.
Yeah.
Those are arteries?
Nerd fight.
What do you think they are?
Wow. I thought they were veins.
Yeah, but where's the blood getting to the veins?
Yeah, where's the blood,
so
Bob?
Vain.
It's a two-way street, Bob.
Yeah, Bob.
That's well, right. You go both ways. So anyway, I have a question about this whole reading the eye thing.
Yes.
If you were wearing a colored contact lens, that wouldn't work then.
For your iris?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be like taking your fingerprints wearing gloves.
What do you mean?
Nice analogy.
No, why? Because you're looking through the pupil. It doesn't matter what's in front of it.
No, Jay's talking about the iris. You're talking about the retina. Yeah, for the retina, it doesn't matter. If you're doing an iris scan, though, then, yeah, of course the contact lenses would
be. Yeah, that would.
Okay, let's vote.
I'm sorry. I'm going to need to open up my fifth grade science book so I can follow along. Because
all right,
all
pupils, let's focus here.
Confuse me.
Now, the backup, the runner-up story to that one today is in 1954, synthetic diamonds were produced at General Electric Research Laboratories. 1954, they made the first synthetic diamonds.
Is that wow. With zirconia?
1954, that was the year they did that song, Synthetic Diamonds Are a Cyborg's Best Friend.
Oh.
Come on. No.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Lucy in the Sky with synthetic diamonds.
That would be LSSD.
No, that's not as funny.
Yeah.
Well, we have some news items this evening. We should probably press on. I know you're all having a lot of fun with everything. The first item, and the headline of this one just kills me in its inaccuracy. It's stunning inaccuracy. Dreams may no longer be secret with Japan computer screen. Another headline read that we will be able to read... to record and view dreams.
Yeah, this is really cool. Ever see a science news item that where your jaw just kind of like drops an inch or so? I love it when that happens. Jay and Evan, like within an hour of each other, both sent me an email with this. And the title was something like, Scientists Develop Software That Can Map Dreams. Researchers at the ATR Computational Neuroscience Laboratories in Japan have been able to deduce what someone is seeing purely from brain imaging. The private institute said in a statement that it was the first time in the world that it was possible to visualize what people see directly from brain activity. Chief researcher Yukiyasu Kamatani said that by applying this technology, it may become possible to record and replay subjective images that people perceive like dreams. So that ties into the title that you were reading, Steve.
Yeah.
But how they did it is interesting. They took their test subjects and they used 400 black and white control images. And they took these images and showed them to each person one by one for 12 seconds each. That must have taken a while. Each image was a grid of like a 10 by 10 pixel grid. What those images did was to actually calibrate the machine. The machine is an fMRI, a functional magnetic resonance imager, which detects blood flow, and in this case, in the visual cortex. And as the subjects were looking at these control images, it actually calibrated the machine. Apparently, I guess each person is different, and each one required calibration in a little differently than other people. Does that sound right, Steve?
Although, to be clear, they weren't calibrating the fMRI itself. The fMRI is just reading, inferring brain activity from blood flow. Yeah, it's calibrating the software that's interpreting the fMRI signal.
Right.
So essentially what they're looking at is a part of the visual cortex that maps to the retina. So this is definitely the low hanging fruit for this kind of application. It's, you know, we know from previous studies that the brain actually does map physically, you know, to the images that are impinging upon the retina. And so that's exactly what they could do. They could just calibrate the software by looking at these multiple images, and they could get this essentially this pixelated, very low res, black and white picture, you know, sort of which parts of the brain are being activated by an image that someone's actively looking at. The software can generate from that this low res kind of fuzzy image that's enough, especially if you have multiple samples, to read a word. So I think like one of the words that they showed was the word neuron, I guess, just to be ironic. And you could read it. You know, you could say, yeah, that's what the person is looking at. You can read the word.
Yeah, it's definitely no pareidolia going on there. It's pretty obvious. It's a little indistinct, but it's obviously what they saw. Now, Steve, are you saying that these images were actually, I mean, I thought that they were constructing, using the software, they were reconstructing what the people saw. But are you saying that the way that the neurons are lit up, there's not that much processing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're choosing the part of the visual cortex that has the least amount of processing. That's essentially just, you know, bringing the raw image in mapped from the retina. The more processing the cortex is doing, the harder it would be to use this technique. If you're trying to infer, you know, more complex images, you know, this technique wouldn't necessarily apply. That, of course, remains to be seen. This isn't the first group to do that, by the way. You know, another group did it, but they...
It was different. It was different.
They had a limited set of images. Like, they were trying to say which of these 12 images is the person looking at.
Right.
Whereas what the slight advance here was that they showed that you could have an open-ended, you know, choice at the end. Like, what word are they looking at?
You call that slight?
Well, it's still the same basic technology generating a very low res image, but it is an improvement. But I don't think it's a game changer. It's not that dramatic. This is cool in that it's a proof of principle. It shows that you can, you know, even with a fairly low resolution imaging of brain activity, the functional MRI scan, which actually just measures blood flow to the brain and then infers which parts of the brain are active by how much blood flow it's getting. It's pretty low res, actually, you know, especially compared to the level of like neurons interacting with each other and, you know, the signals that would go into creating an actual image. You know, the patterns at which the brain lights up is predictable. You can calibrate the software based upon previous patterns of brain activity and then infer from that what a new image that somebody is looking at. Extending this to other types of brain activity, like let's say you're thinking of a picture rather than actually looking at it. That's the next logical step. That remains to be demonstrated. And I think that probably, you know, would work out. We'll see. But then going to more complicated things, you know, who knows, motion, three-dimensionality, you know.
Well, they're talking about, actually, Kamatani himself is saying that eventually they may be able to apply this to senses other than vision, such as feelings and complicated emotional states as a
Yeah, but that's a totally different ballgame.
It is, absolutely.
You know, the brain has a pretty topical map of sensation as well, like the different parts of the body, so that, you know, could work using the same level of technology. But emotions and, you know, sounds are mapped a little bit in a much more complicated way. And again, the more processing that's going on, the harder it would be, you know, to apply this technique. So that's why the thing that, you know, of recording your dreams, I mean, why pick that out of all the things that this kind of technology might be applied to? And that's also so far downstream from what this is doing. Again, Bob, when I blogged about this, I equated this to equating the slight advances in the metamaterials to an invisibility cloak. You know, it's like, why talk about the invisibility cloak of all things? That's just sort of the sexy really
right.
far.
It's a hook.
Like the
that's
least plausible, the most downstream application of it that you could think of. Yeah, that's just the hook for the headline writers.
What immediate, what applications do you see then before the Dream VCR?
At this level, I think just research. I think this is really just a research tool. It'll be a while, I think, before there's any practical applications. And probably, if it can be used to image what somebody's thinking as opposed to what somebody's
right.
looking at, then that it could be another way to mentally control a computer and by extension a robot.
Right.
So it could be used for communication.
Like I was thinking when I was researching this, Steve, you know, that the inner voice that everyone has where you could actually mentally imagine saying something and it really feels like you're saying it, which is distinct, you know, to the state when you're not saying something. If that can be read somehow, I've seen anime science fiction where the characters actually communicated mentally that way through technology,
yeah.
and using this inner voice. If they could somehow tap into that for, like you said, computer control or even communication
yeah.
person to person, that would be quite an achievement.
Yeah, I think that will take much more finer level of reading of activity.
Oh, yeah.
And the current fMRI technology might not be up to that. And also will probably take a much more elaborate calibration. And that's one of the key limitations to this technology is that mm-hmm. the calibration phase is exhaustive. And that's just for the simplest
application. Well, look at that. 400 images, 12 seconds each. And then the experiment starts. Once that's
yeah.
done, then they can actually start the experiment.
That might become prohibitive if you start to get to more complicated processing. Or they just need to figure out new ways to calibrate it. Because everyone's brain's slightly different. I mean, I don't think you could... You may start with a very, very basic plan, but there's going to be so many differences, from person to person, that you're going to have to go through an elaborate period of calibration. The question will be, is can that be automated? But imagine right. listening to hours and hours of audio in order to get the computer to understand how your brain is processing sound so that it could then... extrapolate from the signal to what you're thinking, what sounds you're thinking of, or words you're
yeah,
thinking of.
If it could be done in the background, though, it wouldn't be too onerous then if it's just done, when you're watching TV or just and times when you're just doing other stuff and you don't really mind.
How would that work, though? Because it's got to be standardized. I mean, you'd have to have, be listening to something where the computer has to know what you're listening to, right?
Right.
You have to be free from other distractions. I mean, one of the big limitations with an fMRI scan is that it's hard to isolate the signal that you're looking for because every thought that you have, every stray sensory
right.
sensation, everything is creating other brain activity, and that's all adds noise to the signal that you're trying to pull out. So I would imagine that any calibration would have to occur with the least amount of such noise. So that means not doing other stuff. That would mean you're doing
yeah.
nothing but focusing entirely on the calibration signal. So anyway, this is totally cool, but this really is a very new technology in its infancy. And any real cool applications, I think, are still, in my opinion, decades away. And there's going to need to be advancements on multiple fields. But I would guess... The earliest, non-research applications of this would be in, communication for the impaired, for example. Any way that you can that you can use a computer with your mind will be hugely advantageous, Well, let's move on. One more news item. We're going to end on a lighthearted one. A burglar claims that he was trapped while burgling a house was trapped in the house for 3 days by a ghost.
Me started.
This happened in Malaysia. Okay, so we take it to the other side of the wonderful world, to Malaysia, in which, like you said, Steve, there was this burglar and he went in to rob the house. He entered through the back door and then suddenly he was blinded once he was inside and felt like he was in a cave. And he's quoted as saying, "Each time I wanted to flee, I felt a supernatural figure shoving me to the ground." That's what he told police. So much so that he stayed there for 3 days until the owners of the home eventually came in and found him. Dehydrated, he hadn't eaten or drank anything in 3 days, so he was not in good shape. you know, very apologetic for having broken into the home. But
a couple of funny bits, though, from the reporting of this, that the guy said that this is the first time it's happened to him in his long career of breaking and entering.
Wow. I mean, how did it trap the guy, though?
He couldn't stand up. Every time he tried to get up, he'd get smacked down, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can mentally work yourself up to a state of fear that really effectively paralyzes you for, like I said, for three days.
But guys, how long would it have gone on? What if the people didn't come home? Would that guy literally have let himself starve to death, basically in self-delusion?
Depends on what state he was in at the end of 3 days. It says in this report that they suspect he might have been on peyote. I don't know how long peyote lasts. It's also possible that he eventually had a seizure, you know, and then the seizures could have put him in a, you know, what we call a post-ictal state, which is basically a delirious state. Or he could have just been there just because of dehydration and maybe sleep deprivation or just, you know, coming off the peyote, whatever. I mean, 3 days is a long time, but there are plausible explanations for how somebody could be in a delirious state for that long.
Post-ictal states are not fun.
Yeah, but how about the claim that he was blinded once he went inside? Like, what was that? That's not some long-lasting effect from dehydration. He said he felt like he was in a cave. Could have been a phobia, certainly, of some kind.
Yeah, but he's been doing this for a long time, Evan.
Yeah, well, he chose a little place to burglarize instead of a bigger place. I don't know.
Or, of course, possibly there was actually a vengeful spirit in the house that decided to keep him
that is captive. That is one of the options.
Yeah, let's stick with the story here. You're right.
Of course, there are other options. So it could have been an invisible Bigfoot that was using him as a love slave.
they get around so much, these invisible big feet. They're
it
everywhere.
Could be a memory implant of sorts from an alien or something.
That's true. These are all just as likely as the ghost hypothesis.
And how about this? The whole article could be made up, top to bottom. That's a possibility.
I think we hit it.
And at the very bottom of the article, it says, if you're feeling afraid of ghosts, check out our gallery of real live Ghostbusters.
In the Asylum article, yeah.
And then there's a picture of some dork with a certificate, and he's taking a picture with the E.T. doll that talks, which I have no idea.
He's not a dork.
Well, anyway, let's go on to some emails and questions. The first question comes from Connor McCrory from Belfast in Northern Ireland. And Connor writes, hello all, I was reading a Cracked.com article about 6 insane discoveries that science can't explain. One item in particular caught my attention, the bloop. I'm not sure how in-depth a humorous website like Cracked's research is, but they say it was an extremely loud sound that scientists say was likely made by an animal. An animal that would have to be much larger than even a blue whale, as the sound was so loud. So is any of this true, and could it really come from a massive undiscovered creature? It all sounds very suspicious to me. Thanks. Have you guys heard the bloop?
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
It's obviously a monster.
Well, here it is. Let me play it for our listeners. What I'm going to play is at 16 times the speed at which it was recorded. So this is 16 times normal speed. So, yeah, I don't know what that is.
Nope, me neither.
I think it's a genuine mystery. But I think we could say one thing for sure. There isn't an animal larger than a blue whale out there somewhere that's undiscovered.
Well, Steve, what about giant squids are potentially much bigger than we know for certain. Much bigger than the ones that have washed up. You know, bigger than a blue whale, but I don't know, but it's probably unlikely. But
there have been some massive ones. What, 50, 60 feet long, dead giant squids have been found?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's counting the tentacles, which wouldn't add to its ability to make a loud noise. You know, they're talking about an animal that has
squids aren't
lungs
likely,
that are huge.
Right. Squids aren't likely because they don't have the gas sacs required to produce it. So they're probably not it.
But the point being, if there's something that big under there that we can't find, there's a chance that there's something else big somewhere in the ocean that we can't find.
Yeah, but first of all, why would it have to be sped up in order to sound like a bloop?
Well, it's an infrasound. It's so low frequency that you really couldn't hear it, I don't think, at normal rate.
Right.
Sounds like a bubble rising to the top of a, you know, a water container in a, you know,
Well, one key bit of information, scientists seem to be pretty certain for some reason that the wave pattern indicates it was made by an animal. Now, I don't know what there could be about a wave pattern that indicates an animal origin, but perhaps it's, you know, perhaps it's still not created by any animal. Maybe it is a natural noise. I listened to the normal, the unsped up version of the sound, and maybe a fissure opened up in the seafloor and released some gas, because it sure sounds like flatulence to me.
Yeah.
Or could it have been like a whale in an echo chamber kind of situation that would have magnified it? Because they're saying that it has to be something a lot bigger than a whale just because of how loud it was. Apparently, it was picked up by separate detectors miles apart.
Right.
So it would have had to have been an extremely loud noise. Although I thought that the infrasound, the really low-frequency sound, traveled extremely well through the water. So I'm not sure why that is.
What are we actually talking about here? Like,
so I think it could be like a whale sound,
but two separate microphones, 3,000 miles apart. Did they say what the time difference was that the microphones picked it up, or was it simultaneous? I don't think this mentions that.
I guess it would just depend on where it was centered in between them.
Well, yeah, I guess did they try to determine
but
that?
What would make the noise? Like, not just what creature, but what kind of activity would make that noise?
Well, you know, like a whale can make noises. It makes noises to communicate with other whales or to, you know.
But wouldn't there be other sounds then? I mean, just some random whale just went like, boop, boop, you know, like some, you know what I mean? Like just one whale just boop.
Well, they could use it as sonar, you know. There are plenty of reasons, I'm sure, that an animal might make a noise, you know.
But that's a good point, though, is why just once ever hear that? That makes it sound like an anomaly, a rare kind of event.
Yeah, that sounds like a seismic event or something. Like I said, fissure that released something, or that had a signature like something that was made by an animal.
Yeah, but I mean, you think of like a certain rare bird making a weird sound. You know, it might be something that we don't manage to catch on tape very often, you know, so
like
it's a big ocean. If it's a rare animal, you know, making a rare sound, then, you know, it's not out of the ordinary to imagine that.
Maybe it's a whale that evolved a mechanism for making an incredibly loud noise, louder than other whales, you know?
Right.
Like a blow?
That occurred to me as well. Why does it have to be bigger than a whale? Couldn't it just be a whale or something smaller that's very efficient at creating these loud noises? I don't know why they immediately leaped to the conclusion of an animal bigger than the biggest whale.
Yeah, maybe the biggest whale went up for some air, went down, released it through its blowhole under the water, and bloop.
But then we would hear it all the time.
Is that, I don't know, is that normal behavior for
whales? I think it's ridiculous for people like us to speculate.
Isn't that what I said way back at the beginning?
I mean, it's interesting to speculate about a genuine anomaly like this. What are the kind of things that could do it? But really, and I tried to read up on it and see like what the ideas are out there, and I really couldn't find much. I mean, if anybody knows a good resource that has the skinny on the bloop, let us know. But I couldn't really find anything beyond the kind of naked speculation that we're throwing out there now.
I'll go the best one I heard is the creature is Cthulhu.
Yeah, that's a good theory.
Ooh. Yeah. I think that's the leading theory right now.
Two whales, one cup.
Maybe it's space docking.
That's it, Evan. That's brilliant.
Oh, man. Something unusual made that noise, or some unusual event. It'll be interesting if they solve that mystery someday. But let's go on to the next question. This one comes from Russ Steger from the United States, Pennsylvania. And he writes, I'm going to skip the pleasantries at the beginning and go right to his question. For a number of years, I was firmly in the camp of intelligent design. After listening to your show and several others, I have realized the error of my ways. There have always, though, been some things that just didn't make sense. I have a couple evolutionary questions that I don't understand and was hoping someone could enlighten me. How did the long neck of the giraffe evolve? If it happened gradually, that would suggest successive, incredibly similar mutations, which seems very unlikely. If it happened all at once, it would seem very unlikely that this long-necked freak would ever have a chance at finding a mate amongst its short-necked relatives. If one of these is the correct explanation, how is that possible, or is there a third alternative that I am unaware? Yeah, that's a very common sort of misconception about evolution, and also there's some legitimate, you know, questions in there, or legitimate mysteries. It seems from the fossil evidence that the giraffe's long neck evolved gradually. It wasn't a single mutation leading from a short-necked giraffe to a long-necked giraffe. But that doesn't mean that there had to be a series of mutations. The third alternative that you're alluding to is that it could just have been a mix of gene frequencies. So certain features, like height and, in this case, giraffe necks, are controlled by many genes, not a single gene, which means that different combinations of those genes would produce different neck lengths, and those combinations and those frequencies, gene frequencies that favored long necks, you know, could have been selected for. The conventional wisdom being that, you know, as giraffes sought out the leaves higher and higher up trees as a food source, obviously those giraffes who could get access to the leaves farther up would be able to survive better than those who couldn't. So the long necks were favored for once they adopted that strategy for getting food. Although the story is certainly much more complicated than that. There's actually a little bit of controversy swirling around this question. There are other factors such as the long neck was necessary because the legs were longer, perhaps for some other reason, like the ability to run faster, and the neck needed to be longer in order to reach the ground to drink. Or perhaps it was a certain amount of sexual selection, as male giraffes use their long necks to fight other males over breeding rights. So there's actually a complex of functions at work here. It's not just the feeding at the tops of trees. The simplest way to put it together is that it just was the sorting of gene frequencies over time so that they lined up in favor of the longer and longer necks. It wouldn't necessarily even involve any new mutations. But of course, if there were the occasional mutation that led to a longer neck, that would provide a significant advantage. Again, once the giraffe ancestors had undertaken that strategy. So there probably was a combination of things, of just gene frequencies with the occasional mutation thrown in. There may have been, you know, while there was gradual increases, there may have been a discontinuity where there was a leap to a new potential for longer necks because of a mutation.
The point being that it was too gradual for any of the girl giraffes to be like, ew, look at the big long neck freak, you know, and so they still managed to get laid. Right? Is that what you're saying?
Right. But
okay.
The other question is legitimate in that if there is a really significant mutation, then how does that new creature,
get laid?
Find a mate? Yeah. And more importantly than that, and this is where the real mystery comes in, is, like, for example, chimpanzees and humans have different numbers of chromosomes. That means at some point along the line, there had to be, like, the first hominoid in the human line that had the new number of chromosomes. And who did they mate with? And that's actually still a bit of a mystery. There are plausible hypotheses as to how that could happen. It basically would involve
cologne, a lot of Dido.
The children and the cousins having to mate with each other. Yeah, I mean, it's not finding a mate, it's having fertile young. You know, if two creatures with different numbers of chromosomes mate, they would not be able to produce fertile young. So that any mutation that involved a change in the number of chromosomes would seem then that it should die out. But there is actually a way, genetically, theoretically, that could result in a stable population with the new number of chromosomes. It's tricky. It's the kind of thing it's actually not likely to happen. But anything that could happen, even if it's unlikely, given enough time, will happen, right? But I don't know that we have enough evidence to say exactly how that happens. This is just a plausible scenario in which it could happen, which is slightly different than what his question is. His question is just if it looks different enough, then it won't be able to find a mate. But that's, you know, I think that, animals are willing to breed pretty far afield, you know.
animals aren't as shallow as you. That's what Steve is saying.
That's basically it. I mean, lions will mate with tigers, you know. And these are actually, you know, legitimate, interesting questions in terms of how these things happen. But you have to understand evolution occurs, you know, more actually once you have a fairly complex genome through just recombination and gene sorting of gene frequencies. It's actually not that dependent on new mutations. But everyone kind of focuses on mutations because that's what everyone talks about, you know.
Yeah, recombination is key.
Well, we actually still have a couple interviews we have not yet used from the Amazing Meeting 6 back in June. So here is the interview we did at TAM 6 with Richard Wiseman.
So I found out the origins of karaoke the other day. It was invented by a man. Guess what his name was?
What was his name?
Steve, do you know
Steve? Oh, that's it. We lost Steve.
Richard, I just want you to know. This happens 3-4 times a year.
All right.
This is happening now.
Anytime you want, Steve. Guess what his name was?
Yeah. Hang on.
Oh, that's too good.
All right.
Just say it.
Go on, just say it naturally.
Was it Joey Karaoke? That was totally natural.
Was it Joey Karaoke?
It wasn't natural.
Right. Interview begin.
Well, sitting with us now is Richard Wiseman. Richard, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Is this a record setting four times?
It feels so much more, but I suspect it's around about four. Yes,
I think it's four. I think he and Phil played are tied now.
Oh. Right. So we've planned a cage match later for you and Phil.
That's great. That's great. Somebody actually just did walk up to me in the corridor and say, "Hi, Phil. Nice to see you again." So the trend
continues.
Never
get old. And
it's very funny. Yeah. It's very funny. Yeah. More people could do that. That would be as great. It's nice.
We put your picture up next to his, and so just people wouldn't confuse the two of you.
Yes,
that never happens.
No,
right?
Not at all. But it's nice to be here in the flesh, because normally we're talking from a very long distance.
That's right.
Yes. That's great.
Over the pond. Mm.
Yes, it's always nice to have the face-to-face conversations. And for our listeners, Richard Wiseman is a psychologist who has been working the intersection between psychology and skepticism, I think, better than anyone else. Tell us about some of the projects you're working on now.
Oh, crazy things. Crazy things.
We love crazy things.
Oh, I like crazy things. Me and crazy, we get on very well indeed. I'm doing a whole load of things. So right at the moment, looking at what happens to self-esteem and social skills in kids when you teach them magic tricks. That's a very big project we're doing, which is this kind of nice idea that you get kids who are a little bit shy and low in self-esteem. You teach them a magic trick. They go out into the playground, get picked on, beaten up by others, and then we laugh at them when they come back. And that's working out well for us. It's building up our self-esteem. It's ruined the kids, obviously. But, you know, you've got to have some fun. So we're doing that. We're doing other stuff on YouTube. And also...
So you're recording the kids getting beaten up and putting it on YouTube?
Absolutely.
I can't wait to see that.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. It's proving to be a big
hit.
It's massive. Massive. There's nothing better. I don't think that sort of material. So here at Tamang, we're talking about testing psychics, particularly in rather difficult situations. So we're talking about some of the tests we did of Indian gurus all those years ago, went to India, went around in the various ashrams, looking at these people who could allegedly perform these incredible feats and turned out to be fraudulent, and talking about some of the tapes that we get hold of Sai Baba, who has a huge following and allegedly materializes objects in his bare hands, and we have a tape that may or may not show him engaging in a little bit of sleight of hand, so I should be showing that.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that at first. So tell us, is Sai Baba more of a UK phenomenon than America? Or
He's more of an Indian.
Indian.
Yeah,
okay.
He's probably the best known of the god men, so he has an estimated following of 13 million in India.
Tell us about him.
Well, he's a phenomenally powerful and well-known godman. So people would essentially see him as a miracle worker. He has a very large ashram or religious retreat. And he has a lot of very influential friends. So his ashram has a helipad on it, which gives you an idea of who's coming in and out of there. And when we went to investigate him, there had been a very sort of bloody assassination attempt on him. So when we were there, the place was in lockdown with lots of people with very big guns. And basically, he'll come out very early on in the morning. and walk around the people that have gathered there and sort of make this sweeping motion and produce objects of some sort. And he would do this pretty much every morning. But you can't get very close to that for security reasons and other reasons, I suspect. So we were sort of there to try and investigate this and really couldn't get much. You know, there were just too many people with guns. We just couldn't get very close to it.
Now, just for, did he invite you to
in- Oh, no. No one invites me anywhere. I haven't been to
you
a
asked
party.
For permission?
Not as such. No, we turned up. Okay. And then went in, and it's sort of a religious retreat, so anyone can go in and stay there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's huge. I mean, thousands of people staying there. Then I was sending some faxes back to the UK, and it was quite obvious from the content of the faxes that I was very sceptical about things. And one of the people who helped me send on the faxes sort of sidled up and said, "You know, there does exist tape of him allegedly cheating." And I said, I didn't know that. And they said, yeah, this tape is out there. And then this story broke, which is exactly the story there, that yes, indeed, that the essential, what's called the Doordarshan, which is the national television station in India, had filmed him materializing an object, but actually allegedly found he was cheating. And they had squashed that. They destroyed the tape. But the engineer had made a copy of it before it was destroyed.
Nice.
So I tried to find that copy, which was kind of tricky to do, but eventually managed to track it down, paid a fairly large sum of money for it, and then brought it back to the UK, and it's since appeared on various documentaries about psychics. But I can remember being there, and I had this tape, and I suddenly realized I hadn't actually seen the tape. I'd seen the footage, but I didn't know whether the tape I was holding was this actual footage or not. So I thought I'd better go back and check it out.
After you've paid for it.
That's correct. So that's the kind of hard-nosed negotiation that I do.
That's why people don't invite you anywhere.
That's right. I give you large sums of money. You could give me anything. I have no idea what it is.
Now that I think that maybe people should invite you places more often.
You'd think so. You'd think.
You got invited to Tam.
That's right. Yes. It's the same sort of negotiative strategy, actually. So I had this thing. So I thought I'd better go back to the hotel and check that it is there. And I went back and I said, can I see this tape I've got? And they said, go down to the basement because there's a VCR machine there. So I went down, put it on, and yes, indeed, this was the tape that I wanted. And then my colleague came running down and said, what on earth are you doing? And I said, I'm just watching the tape. And he said, no, that's the machine they use to play the films into every single room in this hotel. You are playing in this highly sensitive
God,
tape.
You've got to be kidding.
So we were out of there extremely quickly. Ooh. So that was my little
moment.
Wait, so
that was broadcast like on TVs all over the hotel?
The entire hotel. Oh,
did anyone freak out? Anything?
I have no idea. We just left. I went upstairs, threw everything in a case, and we were out of there because if they'd have known we'd got that tape, that would have been bad news.
Were you actually under sniper fire when you were leaving?
Yes. That's how I remember it. your memories can, that sort of thing can be very, very dodgy. But so yes, that was probably the most dangerous of the potentially dangerous of the investigations. But it's an interesting context to work in because these people have a lot of power. Of course, a lot of the followers are there because they can do these alleged miracles. And so if you go along and you say, well, actually, I think this is trickery, there's all sorts of power issues there. And you're in an environment where it's kind of quite tricky sometimes to know that you're secure. You know, it is quite an open environment.
So you managed to find the worst VCR on the planet to play that tape in for the first
time. That's correct. That's the type of achievement.
I love you. I love
you. So please don't.
No,
don't do high-five stuff. That just makes me feel ill.
You're going to have to do your fake high-five.
No.
So I'll be talking about that and showing the footage. So,
Look
yes.
forward to seeing that. That's great.
And he's actually going to be playing it on all the televisions.
That's right. I'm thinking, what harm could it do?
Right. I think they have a big screen right outside on the strip. You just play it right there.
That was kind of fun. And we tested several other sort of gurus out there.
Did you test the love guru when you were out there?
Not personally, no. Okay. But if is it him or is it he or she or?
It's a movie.
Mike Myers.
I didn't know that.
Some horrific movie coming out.
I'm sorry, what's the pop culture?
No idea.
You know the guy. You know who Dr. Evil is?
Yeah.
Yeah. The guy who did that is. This is his new bit.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
It
looks terrible.
Yeah. Myers. It makes Dr. Evil look great, though.
I'm trying to think of Mike Myers. Other half.
No.
Oh, I don't know.
Neil Malarkey.
Oh.
Neil Malarkey. I didn't know Mike that. Myers.
Malarkey?
Yes. Malarkey. Very funny man.
Huh.
Does improv. In
Isn't that a word? Doesn't that mean like BS?
Yes. Yeah. Malarkey.
Ah,
you're full of malarkey.
Malarkey.
Yeah. Yep. He does a very funny shtick where he's a fake motivational speaker.
Yeah. And it kind of writes itself, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So, that's an oxymoron. So he has a tagline of don't be needy, be succeedy.
It's funny when, you know, we're in the Flamingo Hotel and there's a few other conventions going on here, business conventions, and that's not far off from the posters you see up, you know, with those really cheesy corporate sort of motivational slogans on that make you want to puke.
Well, Richard, you do things like that, don't you?
I have no idea what you're talking about. No, absolutely not.
That's funny because we were just talking a few weeks ago. You were in Boston for something.
I can't remember. It's all very foggy. Very bad memory. Okay. Very, very bad memory for that sort of thing. The corporate side of what I do is far more cognitive, actually, rather than motivational. So I never get anyone to sort of go shout yes or anything like that.
You don't motivate anyone.
No, I'm more of a demotivational speaker. People look at me and they think, whatever he does, don't do it.
Right. Stay in school, kids.
Yes. My new sort of motivation is instant pity. So I walk on and it's instant pity.
It's just,
and they go, pity. Okay. It's a shame, isn't it? Yes. Yeah.
Poor thing.
It works well. Yeah. It's one of the bigger companies that book that.
So do you study the whole corporate psychology thing?
I don't really study it. I go out and do it. So I do go out and speak to corporations mainly about luck. And how to get lucky. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you tell other people how to get lucky.
The irony is obvious. But I walk out. And of course, in psychology, is this whole thing of in terms of happiness, there's no absolute measure of happiness. It's who you compare yourself to. So if you always compare yourself to people who are more than you, you're always going to be unhappy. So by walking out on stage, it elicits what I call downward comparisons. They would think, my goodness, look at that poor disheveled professor. And they feel good about themselves for about sort of 20 minutes. And then I walk off and that's that.
That's really a high that lasts all day.
I think it's been
years for some people, apparently. They regularly visit my website for updates on so it feels good about themselves. Yeah.
So what else do we have going on at TAM with you?
With me?
Yeah.
Well, I should also be, fingers crossed, doing a mass participation event. Mm-hmm. We've had a few logistical nightmares with it, but that's always the case with these sorts of things. So we're hoping to get the whole audience, which for my talk will be both of them, involved in a major, a big mass participation thing. But it's also a big secret thing, so I'm not going to say too much about it, in part because it might not happen.
Okay.
And second, if it does, it still won't be that good.
You know, we all know already what it is.
I assume so. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could tell us.
He's lying.
I know. It's a big. We can cut this out if you want to. It's the big spoon bending thing, right?
No. Not anymore.
Ooh,
as of last night.
It's migrated. My information is more than 12 hours.
What are you going to do with all that cutlery?
We haven't got that anymore as of last night.
Oh, wow. That's a logistical nightmare.
That's a logistical nightmare.
He must have contacted the same vendor you had for our swag.
Yeah.
Massive problems.
No, I'm joking. We have got it. And it is the spoon bending. So,
Now that was a psychological trick. Isn't that called a lie?
Yes.
Let me look that up.
Google it. Yeah.
Okay. So that you're still trying to get the pull off the whole mass spoon bending thing.
Your mass participation things are interesting. And I quite like the idea of people actually doing things as opposed to just sitting around talking about them. If you look at sort of history of skepticism, there's been lots of sort of armchair skepticism versus kind of going out there. And I think mass participation stuff's interesting because there's this, again, psychological theory that if you get people to do a small thing, so if you get them to be, I don't know, just tidy up a little bit around the house, for example, then it has a massive impact on their kind of sense of self-identity because they look at their behavior and they think, well, what sort of person would do this? Oh, it's a sort of person that would, you know, generally want to be helpful and so on. And so that very small act then actually grows over time and they end up doing much bigger things, the kind of foot in the door technique in terms of persuasion. So with mass participation, if you can get a lot of people to do a small thing, that may kick off bigger changes with them. So it's one of the reasons why I'm interested in that, not only because it's a fun thing to do, but actually it might lead to long-term sort of behavioral shifts.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a psychological butterfly effect.
Absolutely. Yes.
You can use that, by the way.
I won't. It's desperation, but it's not that bad.
I have an offbeat question for you. And everybody shudders when I say
I know, when even you can recognize it as offbeat.
Get the editing tools ready. I think about the evolution of socially how humanity has evolved. Now, if you took, you know how they do that thought experiment? If you take a bunch of people, put them on an island, that they're going to basically go through the same things that any other group
of humans are going through at that, you know, whatever. Like, they develop a society for 100 years and they'll basically be same as any other human society.
No idea what you're talking about.
You ever heard about that?
No. I've seen Lost.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Does that count?
Yeah, right.
Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, Gilligan's Island.
See, that actually, yeah, the two different cultures sprung up, I think. If you look at Lost and Gilligan's Island, so I think that immediately.
About 50 years of difference.
Well, let me rephrase the question something else. Are we hardwired? Is all of our behavior and social behavior hardwired? So if you did do that, if I flew them to another planet, totally isolated, do you think that human psychology would be identical there that it is here, or how much of it is actually societal pressure?
Oh, you see, I'm a social psychologist, so I'm not a fan of the kind of hardwired notion at all. I think some sorts of things are. Yeah. I mean, if you take a baby and you put them on a table, they tend not to crawl over the edge and fall to the ground because edge detection and so on is hardwired for good reason. But, that's quite funny, of course, if they do. Mm-hmm. But they don't last very long.
Only if you film it and put it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Or tempt them over.
Right, with candy. I've done
or
that.
Lettuce.
So you think most of it is learned behavior?
So to get back to your question, yes. So I think the majority of it is not only learned, but it's relatively easy to modify. I think that's the key point. So to get back to the luck work, this notion that, you know, you're okay, so it's all kind of hardwired, and we were hardwired to be evil or hardwired not to think rationally or whatever. I don't believe for one moment. I think a lot of this is socially constructed, and that you can change people, and it doesn't actually take a great deal. And you know, some of the work on self-perception theory, as long as you can get them to behave in a certain way, they start to change how they think and feel about the world. So if you get them to smile, if you force their face into a smile, they start to feel happier. And I think you can use that same process to kick off interesting changes in thinking.
Mm-hmm. So the nature versus nurture thing, no go.
You're on the nurture side of that.
Yeah, I just think the nature side of it is not so interesting. I just think all I care about is what can be changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why would you care about something that you can't change?
Right.
So, you know, if we look at people behaving irrationally or not being superstitious or whatever, I think my only interesting question for me is how do you change that? Not, is it hardwired in the brain? Well, it is. Well, that's the end of that then.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just interested in that notion of how you encourage people to go forward, for example, from TAM and do something different that they didn't do before they came to TAM.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because there's 900, 1,000 people here, everyone doing something a little bit different could make a big change. And so one of the things I'll be talking about when I speak is this notion that in the past, certainly, you know, sort of 10 years ago when I was doing this, there were kind of people who sort of stopped you getting your message out or helped you in terms of television producers or commissioning editors for books. And if they didn't like you, they didn't like your message, you couldn't get it any further. That was that. The internet, of course, I think is far more democratic. Anyone can put something on there. And so we have this huge potential now to go beyond what we had a few years ago and to really get our message out there. But you've got to encourage people to behave in certain ways.
Have you ever found anything that you couldn't change that you previously thought maybe you would be able to change, but you just can't change it?
You know, I just sort of wouldn't even think about the question. I think that if we really can't change it, then let's just forget about it and let's act as if we can change everything, because probably we'll do a bit better that than a kind of fatalistic, no, there are things you can't change. Yeah. I'm sure there are some things you can't, but let's just pretend they don't exist.
Yeah, but I was thinking of, have you found something that you tried and tried and tried and said, wow, we just can't change that?
Well, certainly with the luck research, there are some people who are very unlucky that we just couldn't reach. With most people, you change the way they think and behave, and you change their luck. With some unlucky people, they were so comfortable with being unlucky. It was so part of their identity. They were scared of change, and they were very, very difficult people to reach. But again, I think you're actually better off just ignoring that and saying, let's imagine those people weren't out there. Right. Let's pretend we can, and let's see how far we can go with it.
Okay.
So for me, TAM is about getting people a lot more empowered and into this notion of getting out there and doing stuff rather than just thinking about it.
And your hypothesis is that you have much more of an effect on how people think by having them do something, even very small, than lecturing at them for hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think the classic, you know, don't tell me, show me, mm-hmm. is one, but then don't show me, get me to do it,
right.
is the other. So one of the things, again, I'll be talking about with the Color Change card trick video, is that has actually been fairly successful. It's about 2.5 million views on YouTube, and it's led to a piece in the Penn & Teller show, and it's been on Discovery very recently, and so on. actually, when I put that together, I just did it because it was fun. It cost about, well, $50 to make that little clip. I didn't think it would be massively successful. I just did it because I wanted to do it and it was fun. It's just led to then a lot of interesting things happening. So I think part of it is saying to people, just do it. Just get out there and try stuff and see what happens. Because I think skeptics tend to be a little bit pessimistic about the world. We can't change it. We can't make an impact. And therefore, they don't try. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think there is, particularly with the internet, a huge potential to make that impact.
But do you think that that's unique to skeptics? Or do you think that that's just something that, in general, people feel that they can't make that little difference?
I think it's not unique to skeptics, but it's certainly a feature of skepticism. Because we tend to be rational about things. And we're probably right most of the time. We probably won't make much of a difference most of the time, but not all of the time. And so shifting people away from that rational viewpoint, if you like an irrational one, of actually we do have more power and influence than we think, means that little 10% gets mopped up and we do make a difference. So my feeling with skeptics, much as I love them, is that often they are rather pessimistic. And in some, I think some actually enjoy this rather idea of being sort of attacked by this great kind of sort of subculture. And you think that what we have achieved in you know, sort of 30, 40 years of organized skepticism, it's colossal. You know, we punch way above our weight in terms of numbers of people. There's a handful of skeptics in the world, high profile ones, but they achieve a huge amount in terms of media appearances and so on. So I think there is an enormous potential with the internet, because it's one of the themes of SCAM at OTAM with the iSkeptic. I think there's an enormous potential for people to go out and to just try and make that difference.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that certainly is why we're doing what we're doing.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a huge leap of faith for us, if you will, in that we're putting tons of time and effort and hours into something, hoping that it works out, you know, really without any prior experience or prior example. And it's
but that's great. Yeah. You learn as you go along. Mm-hmm. And also because you're not coming from a strong background of doing this in other domains, you may end up doing something that other people haven't thought of. Mm-hmm. And then you become the leaders in doing this type of thing. And so I know I get regular emails from about the color change card trick. I got one this morning from an ad agency.
Can you give us the quick?
Okay, the color change card trick is just a simple illustration of how we're not quite so good at perceiving the outside world as we think. And you watch a strip of video and you miss major changes in it. And as I made the clip very quickly, but now it's on YouTube and it does fairly well. And it's like an advert for that type of work. What's interesting is I get emails from people who want to make similar videos in all sorts of different contexts who say, okay, what do I need to do? Because you've done this. You're the expert.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not the expert. I just had a go at it and it kind of worked out.
Yeah, right.
So you become the expert in this new evolving form because it is all pioneering stuff.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's what makes it exciting. I think skepticism has a huge amount to contribute. If you look at YouTube, the number of skeptical videos that do really well with their magic tricks or science demos, often they're up there with millions of views, and there's no other outlet for that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't easily get that stuff on television.
Yeah. Right.
Yet people are making these things, people are watching them, and I think it's no reason to feel pessimistic about the future at all.
Well, having done this sort of before the internet revolution, Web 2.0, and now afterward, it is a completely different world, because the ability to reach, you know, as an activist skeptic, to reach people and affect the world is completely different now than what it was before. And the biggest thing is as you're saying, it costs very little to experiment. We can do so. Let's try to do this. It'll either work or it fail. And if it fails, we go on to the next thing. If it works, it works. And the upfront investment is so little with the internet. Once you have a website, that's really all you need.
And then the feedback is so quick. So the television program, having just made a series in the UK, it goes out. We don't really get feedback on which of those episodes worked and didn't. It's a long way down the line. With this sort of stuff, you get it instantly. With YouTube, it works or it doesn't. You learn as you go along. So I think that's absolutely great. And as I say, we will be the pioneers, I think, in this.
What other – are you working on more YouTube videos? Is this like an ongoing project? Has it worked out? Or?
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of very haphazard. I just sort of sit there and think, this will be fun. Let's try this. So I've produced one recently, and there's a few people I send them around to before I put them on the internet, and that was an absolute disaster. I loved it. Everyone else hated it. So I ended up arguing with people that it was the most brilliant thing ever.
It was just unique.
It was too good. It was too good for them.
The Philistines didn't appreciate your genius. Yeah. What are you going to do?
That's how I see it.
You got to aim lower.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing we shouldn't forget is that when I was looking at the talk this morning, one the reason that I got into psychology, in part because I'm a magician, but also because I came across something called the Thatcher illusion, which is an amazing optical illusion to do with facial perception.
Creepy.
It is very, very creepy. I came across that, and you can't look at that and walk away and just go, oh, well, whatever. You know, I wanted to know what was happening and so on. And that event had a huge impact on me and changed my life. And the same with these broadcasts, the same with YouTube. Even if you, let's say, on YouTube got 10,000 views, let's imagine it's one kid who sees that and because of that goes to the library or looks elsewhere on the internet and library. That then kicks off something, mm-hmm. becomes a catalyst mm-hmm. for it. That's a huge thing to yeah. have achieved.
Or God forbid, it becomes a magician.
There's no life that quickly. But you know, we shouldn't forget it's individuals. When you look over the history of skepticism, you've got a handful of people that have made a massive difference. But you only need a few of them. Mm-hmm. And it's these sorts of activities which may well act as a catalyst for those people.
I would dare to bet that every magician became a magician because they saw a magician.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it may not be a famous magician. It might have been a guy that came to your local school mm-hmm. and did something. And that's what I want to be. So we shouldn't forget that we make the difference in people's lives, I think. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, not very often, but it doesn't take a lot to really influence history.
What other projects are you working on? So you're still investigating psychics. You got the YouTube stuff going on. What else?
I'm writing as we speak. Well, not literally as we speak. That would be rude. A follow up to Quackology. Mm-hmm. So that's done very well in the UK. So writing a second one there, and I have a very exciting project which unfortunately I can't talk about. Which is one of the reasons I'm here in Vegas is I'm doing some other work as well connected with magic. So there should be some other work further up the line.
Some super secret psychology.
Super secret site. We're doing a huge experiment here in Vegas to try and get people to bet more and more money in the casinos. It's working very well.
Congratulations. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You'll tell us about it when you can.
Yeah, we're about 6 months away from actually talking about that. So the way I tend to work is that it's kind of scattergun approach. I have lots of different things and some of them work out and a lot of them don't. So, mm-hmm. But the ones that do, it's kind of fun to follow them through.
So you play the odds a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Speaking of casinos and betting, you know, we're in a casino, and everyone here is trying to get lucky and trying to maximize their luck. There's a tremendous amount of superstitious thinking, I believe, surrounding about that. So what, have you done anything specifically with gambling?
Not really. The Luck Project avoided that because, obviously, the way to get lucky here is not to gamble. Mm-hmm. You know, the odds are against you. I think Penn and Teller have this nice line that only in Vegas is 98% payback a good offer on it. So, so not really. What we did do was look at lottery playing and luck. So there, which is sort of similar in the sense you're up against a random system. We had 1,000 exceptionally lucky and unlucky people send us in the lottery numbers that they were going to choose for that week's draw in the UK. And my assistant and I went through them all and did an analysis to look at the numbers the lucky people were choosing that the unlucky ones were avoiding, because we thought if there wasn't any sort of thing psychic or weird going on, we would have the winning lottery numbers. Mm-hmm. And we bought that ticket and lost our money because not one of them came up. So the lucky people were far more optimistic about winning, but in reality, they're up against a random system. They're no more better.
So it didn't matter.
Didn't matter at all. What was interesting is that if you did believe in a magical universe, as in you thought that the games were not chance, that, mm-hmm. that you could do mm-hmm. things to increase your chances of winning the lottery, you were far more likely to play. Mm-hmm. So when we see in Vegas all these things with luck and superstition and all these, you know, try your luck here and so on, it's all buying into this notion of it's not chance. Yeah. You know, you don't see the word chance mm-hmm. in Vegas. You mm-hmm. see the word luck because that's some sort of agency that we can control mm-hmm. and so on.
Well, they know their industry perfectly. You know, down to the decimal point, they know exactly what the percentages are on everything. And I'm sure they spend millions and millions of dollars just figuring out how to draw people into everything. You know, that's the whole game. And keep them there.
I mean, a colleague of mine has looked at what's the best pheromone to put onto a green table in order to keep guys who are already in a aroused state at present at that table.
I wasn't aroused last night.
No, well, that's yes.
You can't prove that.
That. I have a message on my phone that proves otherwise, I think.
Shut up.
So we're being influenced in ways we don't realize.
But
you know.
Wait, so the pheromone thing, back up.
Yeah.
Pheromones don't work, right?
Oh, absolutely.
In what way?
Well, we are creatures of smell. So, you know, where there are some smells we like and other smells we don't like. And certain types of pheromone will attract guys who are in certain stages of arousal.
Yeah. Well, you don't have a problem with that. Okay? Tell us about how to get hot babes.
How to get what?
Hot babes.
Hot
right
babes.
Here. What are you talking about?
Well,
I want two.
Well, I did notice in the street there were people with T-shirts offering to get you a woman within 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's pretty good, man.
Wow. Well, except from a self-perception theory point of view, it's terrible because you kind of think, what sort of person would you be presenting as that you needed a woman that quickly?
Yeah, yeah. I need a woman.
Now! That's right. Yeah. And we were wondering if it's a bit like the pizza delivery thing, where it's 21 minutes, you don't have to pay for
exactly.
it.
Exactly,
yeah.
It's free.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Good luck at that. I just rely on the feng shui, you know, how they organize the feng shui of the casinos. And
right.
That's what yeah, I, that's how I play.
Stuff. Right. That's how you choose what seat to sit at
exactly.
at the blackjack table.
That's exactly right. If the plant is over here as opposed to over there, if the blackjack table is adjacent here.
Anything that you don't think you'll be able to find the answer to research-wise that you're dying to know the answer to, or something you don't think you'll ever get to by the end of your career?
Oh, and many, many things I'm absolutely dying to know the answer to. I think the whole kind of meaning of life, I doubt I will get that one sorted.
42 right?
is one of them. But,
yeah. You know, are you kidding, or do I have to keep going? You're kidding.
Well, we did think of doing some research where people sent in the meaning of life and other people rated the thing, and then we decided it was a very stupid idea. No, I think there are many topics that you know, you don't get time to do. I mean, all I do is what interests me. That's honestly, that is it. That I just think, that's interesting, that's not, and that's pretty much what drives it.
Where can people go to find out more information?
It's an excellent question. Mm-hmm. And
I came up with it all by myself.
That's fantastic. That's actually, I thought that was one of the better questions. Anything that plugs my work is a fantastic question. They can go to richardwiseman.com. They can go to quirkology.com. And there's experiments, there's links to the book there and additional material. And most important of all, there's a photograph of me.
Interesting. So people can get that shot of demotivation.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you print that out, you place it on your workstation every morning, you think that's what happens if you don't eat your vegetables. It really motivates people.
Very powerful.
What about YouTube? Search your name, last name, should be good enough?
Absolutely. Yeah, or just the phrase pornography and goat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably I'd rather you didn't use that.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for sitting down with us. It's always a pleasure.
Always.
Well, thank you.
Well, mostly. It's always
fascinating. Thank you. Yes. It well,
it's always a pleasure. It's sometimes.
It's occasionally.
We're looking forward to our mass spoon bending.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
Your secret is safe with us. I assure you.
I hope so. Yes. Yeah. It is going to be quite tricky, I think. But, well,
it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yes.
I get to bring a souvenir home with me.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you.
And just for a bit of follow-up, the massive spoon-bending trick actually worked out quite well, and you could see it if you get the DVD of TAM 6 from the James Randi Educational Foundation.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
A.
B.
Yes, okay. Begin now.
Here we are. Item number one. Scientists find that pain hurts more if you believe it was inflicted on purpose. Item number two. Scientists discover two new species of crocodile in Africa. And item number three, a new analysis reveals that the Earth's magnetosphere has increased in strength by 10% over the last century. Rebecca, go first.
Aw, man. Do I have to?
Yeah.
So scientists find that pain hurts more if you believe it was inflicted on purpose. That makes sense to me. I get angrier if it was inflicted on purpose, so that could increase the perceived insult and injury. So I'll say that's true. Two new species of crocodile in Africa. That sounds believable, I guess. I absolutely know nothing at all about crocodiles. I know how to tell the difference between a crocodile and an alligator, and that's about it. The answer being that their snouts are skinnier and they have teeth on the outside.
That's a croc.
But not like that's going to help if one's like chomping on you. Like, you know, you're
also, crocodiles are more aggressive.
That's true. And the Earth's magnetosphere increasing in strength by 10% over the last century. I'm kind of at a loss this week. these are completely outside of my comfort zone, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for nothing. I'm going to just take a stab and say that they did not discover two new species of crocodile in Africa. They probably discovered them in like New Brunswick or something. You're just trying to throw us off.
Okay, Bob.
So that's fiction.
Let's see. The first one, the scientists find pain hurts more if you believe it was inflicted on purpose. That makes sense. The anger from the fact that it was inflicted on purpose, I see like a feedback loop on the actual perceived pain. That seems to make sense to me. Scientists discover two new species of crocodile in Africa. I'm going to buy that one. A lot of times they have subspecies of animals and they realize that, hey, this isn't really a subspecies. It's actually a full-blown new separate species or something like that. That happens a lot. Or maybe they're just new species that weren't really identified, or maybe they were mistaken. So I'm going to buy that one. The third one about the Earth's magnetosphere increasing in strength by 10% of the last century, I'm not buying that. That would be quite a discovery, and I don't know why it would increase in strength. Why would our magnetic field be increasing in strength to create a stronger magnetosphere? I've never read anything that would give that credence. So I'm going to say that the magnetosphere is false.
Okay, Jay?
The pain hurts more if you believe it was inflicted on purpose. I absolutely agree with that. I've been hurt by people.
And you liked it.
It was painful. So I agree with
that. I said I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. I'll get over it, but I will be angry for a while. And
your
then
words were hurtful.
Discovering two new species of crocodiles in Africa, like, okay, that doesn't seem like anything strange to me. They're discovering new species all the time. Did you guys hear about all the new species they found in China recently?
Yeah.
No tangents.
1,000 over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
That's wicked. New mammals, too.
But that's what Steve wants you to think. He wants you to think of that story and be like, oh, so I guess they're crazy with species in Africa, too.
I mean, if anything, you'd figure they'd find more than that. You know, Africa's a big place. The last one, a new analysis reveals that the Earth's magnetosphere has increased in strength by 10% over the last century. I would tend to agree with that because Magneto has been beating...
Not the X-Men.
All right, sorry.
Different thing.
I'm going to agree with Bob. I think I would have heard of that even if it came out just today.
Okay.
So I think that one's the fake.
All right, Evan?
So scientists and pain and hurting and inflicted on purpose. Well, I mean, pain is just so subjective, and this is also equally subjective, and therefore I think it makes sense. The two new species of crocodile in Africa, is this some trick like where there are no crocodiles in Africa, or it's alligators instead or something, therefore crocodiles in Africa would be a rare thing to begin with? However, that last one with the magnetosphere increasing strength by 10% over the last century, I guess I'll agree that that one is fiction, although I'm not sure why. Maybe they didn't have accurate means of measuring the magnetosphere 100 years ago.
Well, so is that your decision, Evan?
10% figure is dubious. Yeah, so I'll say that one's fiction.
Well, that's an interesting point. I just realized that I think the magnetosphere was discovered in the 1950s. So a century ago, we had no idea that it even existed. So there goes that.
You are so full of yourself, sir. Just because we didn't know it existed doesn't mean that we couldn't have known what it was.
Well, you all agree that pain hurts more if you mean it. And that one is science. Again, not a surprise. That was a pretty straight up one. The experience of pain is extremely subjective. It is modified by a lot of things. It makes sense that, you know, because pain exists to warn us about either injury or a threat, that we would pay more attention to pain that was inflicted on us by somebody who actually meant us ill, you know, was actually meant to hurt us, as opposed to pain that was inflicted upon us by accident, where that would not represent as much of an ongoing threat. The knowledge that pain was inflicted on purpose might hurt more, get our attention more, because that equals a greater potential threat to us in the future. I guess we'll take them in order. We'll go on to the next one. Scientists discover two new species of crocodile in Africa, and that one is science.
Bah.
These are dwarf crocodiles.
I thought that was far too banal to be.
And
science.
Bob, you were exactly right. Did you read this one? This was thought to be two subspecies But a recent genetic analysis revealed that this is actually three distinct species. So it went from one species to three. Therefore, there are two new species.
Yeah, that happens.
Right. So they knew this population of crocodile, of dwarf crocodiles existed. They just thought it was one species with two subspecies. But now they realize it's actually three distinct species. So the interesting thing about this is that these new species of African dwarf crocodiles were discovered in New York because that's where the DNA analysis was done. Which all means that you're all losers. Now, what that means is that...
No, it means I'm a loser.
Number three, a new analysis reveals that the Earth's magnetosphere has increased in strength by 10% over the last century is complete and utter fiction.
Yay!
What is true about the magnetic sphere...
Yeah, quite the opposite.
...about the magnetosphere...
That's increased by 11%.
...is that it has decreased by 5% in the last 150 years.
That's not good.
Yeah, so it's not increasing. It's decayed. It's had sort of relative decay.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to try to say before, is that they can still measure it even if they didn't know it existed until the 50s. So they probably have ways to measure what it would have been using other
The Earth's methods. Magnetic field strength was measured by Carl Friedrich Gauss for the first time in 1835. Thank you.
Wow.
What?
1835. Gauss!
I know, but he measured the magnetosphere?
That's why the Earth's magnetic field is one Gauss.
Ich habe ein Magnetosphere.
I thought it wasn't discovered until the 1950s.
I thought it was the 50s as well. Actually.
Well, I'm sure there were some things about it that were not discovered till later. But in fact, this also was inspired by, a real news item.
Scary news item.
Researchers identify a new region of the magnetosphere. So the magnetosphere is broken up into various regions, and they recently discovered that there's a new one that they didn't know about before, which is called the Warm Plasma Cloak. Isn't that a cool name?
Wow, I'm not even referring to that story. I guess the magnetosphere was in the news this week.
Is that right? So this is a layer that exists between like the upper atmosphere and the lower magnetosphere, and it actually only envelops about 3/4 of the Earth. It only exists on the night side and on the side of the Earth where it's morning. But in the afternoon side, the side that's had sun for a number of hours, it actually dissipates and doesn't exist. It's a very tenuous layer that's broken apart by light.
Steve, I was referring to some satellites discovered that every now and then a hole is ripped in the magnetosphere as bigger than 4 Earths that allows
that
radiation into our magnetosphere and can cause problems with geostorms and all that stuff. It sounded pretty wicked. I mean, that's a huge hole.
Yeah, I mean, the magnetosphere is critical because that is what protects us from cosmic rays. And the solar wind. So, sources of high-energy particles that would otherwise be slamming into our DNA and breaking it apart. So, yeah, big holes in the magnetosphere, bad. So, congratulations, everyone. Suck it, Rebecca.
Oh, God.
You suck it, Steve. Wow. You're supposed to be the mature one.
I mean, nice try, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's a little late for that, isn't it?
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes.
Suck.
Yeah, suck it, Rebecca. Steve Novell.
Evan, you totally just... Forget it. I quit this podcast.
Oh, come on. What, you were going to say that?
Of course.
Evan, did you steal his thunder?
How was I supposed to know you were going to come up with something so quick and witty?
All right. I have a quote from John Maynard Keynes, who was a British economist. Okay. I have a quote from John Maynard Keynes, who was a British economist, and they called his ideas Keynesian economics, and he had a major impact on modern economics. And he said or wrote, "When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?" John Maynard Keynes. Okay, that was sent in by a listener called David Blanchard. Thank you, David.
A listener called?
That's what we call him.
One quick announcement this week. So I was asked to plug a new skeptical blog called Free Thinking. And this is the blog of the Center for Inquiry Transnational.
This one doesn't have a tilde in it.
Yeah,
the last
no
one,
tilde.
Does it?
It's about time, I have to say. Those guys, I mean, I love the guys up at the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, Council for Secular Humanism, but come on. I mean, it's about time they had a blog. I mean,
yeah. Welcome to the century.
Welcome to the 20th century.
Wow, so you're plugging them and dissing them at the same time?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I know. That was totally a backhanded compliment.
The writers will include our own friend, Joe Nickel.
Cool.
I love Joe Nickel.
Who doesn't even have a computer, so like he's going to be blogging like some Amish guy.
Along with Ben Radford.
Yay, Ben.
Tom Flynn, DJ Grothy, the DJ Grothy hosts Point of Inquiry. Lauren Becker, Debbie Goddard, John Shook, and Derek Araujo.
Whoa.
So it should be cool. Should be a cool new skeptical blog, free thinking blog. I think they just started today.
Good luck, guys.
Excellent.
That sounds
blog's
great.
Number one.
I think I said this to Ben when we were at TAM together, that they really need to start getting into more of the new media stuff. Like it was a real hole in their activities. So I'm glad to see that they're doing that. And he agreed. Ben told us that he's been trying for a long time to really get them to do this.
How's Joe going to blog? I guess he'll hand in his typewritten sheets.
I guess a Joe Nickel does not use a computer. At least last time I spoke with him, he just refuses to enter the computer age.
Analog, wow.
Yeah. So
what's he going to do? Like handwrite it and scan it as a PDF and put it in?
No, he's going to hand it to somebody else who's going to do that for him. If you harass him about the fact that he doesn't use a word processor, he'll happily say, well, I wrote whatever, 20 books. What with a typewriter? How many have you written?
That sounds like the voice of experience, Steve.
Wow.
Yeah, he just said that to me.
It's working. So it's working quite well for him.
Steve, did you actually bust his balls about it?
Of course. How can you not use a computer?
Like, what do you like? Well, you don't even use a computer. I mean, what the hell?
I'm like, Joe, I'll email you with this. I don't have email. What? Don't have email. Come on.
Love him. Love him. He's so good.
If we had a million more guys like Joe, the world would be a better place.
Yeah, I love
him.
Absolutely. He's a great guy.
Yes. A couple quick happy birthdays to Ludwig von Beethoven, Jane Austen, and Sir Arthur C. Clarke. So, happy birthday, folks. Hope you're listening.
Just two more weeks for our 2008 wrap-up episode, so still time to send in your votes for the best science news item or the funniest bit on the show or the best quote or whatever. Just send us your feedback on 2008, and we'll bring that all together for our end-of-the-year wrap-up show. So we're all really looking forward to that. Thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Good
Thank
episode.
You, Steve.
Pleasure as always.
Pleasure.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.